Welcome to Two Dope Boys and a Podcast. I'm Michael Brooks.
I'm Phil McKenzie.
Two Dope Boys is a shout out from the margins. Each week we break down trends using the lens of culture to determine what's significant to your future and why. Welcome to this edition of Two Dope Boys. Phil, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good, man. Great Memorial Day weekend.
Always. We were together, man.
Yeah, man. We had outside the studio shenanigans.
Outside. There's a lot of outside the studio shenanigans.
I love it, man. And finally, spring has come to New York City.
It's like
summer.
We skipped spring. We went straight to summer.
Right into summer.
Illustrious crew member, Mr. Rob Fields.
Glad to be back again. This is Rob Fields. And
Third time,
yes. And
veteran.
Pro.
But even though I've been away, it's been great to see the shows that have been getting, you guys are just stacking major chips here. You know, Grant McCracken show was cracking.
Yes, sir.
Pierce Fox, about to listen. I was listening to you guys on the train today with the recent one with Georgette. That was fun. So there's been you guys have been getting some really great folks on. So, you know, it's growing. Two Dope Boys is turning into Two Dope Boys plus a whole village of people.
Yeah.
That's always the vision.
Yeah. That was the intention.
Great humans like you to come along with us. So thank you.
No, man, it's great to be part of this. So
it's such a love-in right now. I feel like now I got to go into like the brand F up and I got to darken the mood.
Well, you know, that's fine. But that's par for the course.
We all start love, and then who fucked up?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's none of us.
That's true. It is none of us. It's part of the love.
At least not this week.
Yeah. at least not publicly that we're going to air on this.
Oh, video. No. I fuck up all the time. Yeah. I just am not going to highlight it on my platforms.
There you go.
Yeah. So that second picture you put up on Instagram, you should take that down.
Right.
So we're going far away for our brand F up. You know, far in geography, but close in sort of psychological proximity. Chobe laundry detergent has issued what people are calling on the interwebs most racist ad ever? ? And the setup for this ad is Chobe, for those who are not familiar, which is probably everybody who hasn't seen this ad, is a Chinese laundry detergent. And this ad basically shows you a young Chinese woman who is in her apartment, and there's a, you know, black guy, fairly normal looking black guy, comes out and approaches her, goes in for the kiss. She stops him, puts like a laundry detergent pellet in his mouth.
They're kind of flirting at first.
Yeah, there's a little bit of like
he doesn't
flirty
just like
energy.
Come at her for the kiss.
No. They come out.
There's
as if,
reason
like,
to think that maybe
they're
she's
lovers
ready
or
for the kiss.
Yeah, like there's some intimacy between these two. He comes over for the, you know, smooth kiss.
It's not like a home invasion detergent ad.
No.
Yeah.
No, it's a standard laundry detergent ad.
Yeah.
And or seemingly. And as he goes in for the kiss, the laundry detergent pellet goes into the mouth. She shoves him into a washing machine.
A top loader.
Yeah, the top load washing machine. So you got to load this brother in. And then...
And he was wearing sneakers, by the way.
He was wearing sneakers, the whole nine yards. And then once you kind of get the machine goes through the cycle, they open up the top. He comes out as a, you know, standard Chinese/Asian guy.
Oh, they're going to say like Matt.
You know,
You got to
discern that the guy is Chinese. And so,
no, it's true. Yeah.
Clearly, the ad sort of plays on these stereotypes of darker skinned folks, particularly those of African descent, African Americans, what have you, as being somehow dirty. And so by washing him through this cycle and using, you know, this great, you know, Chobe laundry detergent, it can get even the darkest thing can be turned now light. And that's sort of the setup for the commercial, which obviously, particularly in Western press, caused a tremendous amount of controversy and think pieces.
And I have been looking for this because it's like an incredibly effective detergent, but I have not been able to order it.
But now, you know, you can go out and get your Chobe because clearly it works very well. The manufacturer pretty much gave us a fairly generic apology. You know, their first point was that a spokesman from Chobe originally told the China's Global Times that we meant nothing but to promote the product And we had never thought about the issue of racism.
That is actually true. They yeah. did nothing but to promote the product.
But then the right. best part is that the foreign media might be too sensitive about the ad.
So after sorry, you're offended. Yeah. I can't believe it.
After a few more days of that, they issued a slightly longer apology that's in four parts. First part being, we had no intention to discriminate against people of color. We do not make judgments based on skin color. We are strongly opposed to and condemn racism. Point number two, we expressly regret for the controversy triggered by the advertisement and are definitely not trying to avoid responsibility. As for the controversial advertisement itself, we have already terminated promotion efforts and deleted some links to the advertisement online. We hope internet users and media will stop spreading it. Three, the publication of the ad and the exaggerated hype surrounding it caused harm to people of African descent. For this, we sincerely apologize and also express the hope that internet users and the media will not read too much into it. Chobi Laundry Gel Balls is a Chinese local household chemicals brand. We hope the Chinese brand can grow larger and stronger and expand around the world. And that's the apology. So this is like perfect, like China speak, where even within the apology, they still kind of blame media for spreading it. So it was, you know, I'm curious what you guys have to say about this before I get started.
Rob, jump into it first.
Well, it's a perfect, in that regard, in terms of blaming media, it is the perfect apology for our times. The media's fault, you know. Right. But there is a long history, as a lot of the articles point out, in Asian cultures favoring lighter skin, just broadly. So, yeah, and in a homogenous society, of course, they didn't think about race or anything. There's a billion of us that all kind of look alike. Why would we think about that? And I think it still speaks to the Chinese brand sort of how they're still a little isolated in that they don't understand how something like this could have played in the world and did. And, you know, nobody thought about that. And they're like, oh, how funny. You know, it's sort of like the thing that when you talk about things or joke about things amongst your friends, you know, they're sometimes not meant for public consumption, but if they get out, then it's
Why are you looking at me like that, Rob?
Because I'm just talking to you.
I'm just playing with you. Public consumption, Michael?
Public mm-hmm. consumption, yeah. So, you know, I mean, that's kind of the thing that happens when you are in a society that doesn't have a lot of diversity, you don't have to think about a lot of people that are not like how everybody else is.
Right.
And without having to do that, I mean, I think the United States is getting better and better at that only because, you know, folks have over the last, like, I don't know, 200 years been talking about this whole idea of diversity and decentering, you know, whatever was like the white male Western gaze and sort of making people understand the value of diversity. That's a slow process and all that stuff. But people are more sensitive over here because there's been agitation. There hasn't been that same kind of thing over there. This is not any way to like sort of apologize for them, but just saying, you know, you're dealing with a whole other different culture when it comes to which, and they are a culture that, hey, guess what? They're just as color struck as everybody else. So,
I just wanted to highlight. I like part of, I like all of what you're saying, Rob, but there's one that I'll expand on. Because the thing that I just think to be mindful of from a media representation point of view, this ad is atrocious. That's my only kind of just visceral response to the spot is it's kind of shockingly disgusting. And I don't know all of the...
And it's not even original.
And it's not even original, which we'll get to. But I do think that I'm hesitant on the sort of like, these stories are irresistible. Someone else fucked up. And we can all be kind of like, you know, moralistic about it in a certain way. So see, like, you know, this kind of like firestorm about a Chinese company. And I'm not interested in any way justifying or explaining this ad. It's a disgusting ad. But I do think that even what we've already mentioned, it's an isolated media culture. I think the whole way that the apology worked, and it reflects broader issues about how issues that go far beyond laundry detergent, how China perceives itself as with this sort of silent rise and like assuming its proper place in the world and exerting power in its own sort of past histories of humiliations racism and everything else, even as at the same time they want to, you know, occupy Tibet, not ever talk about it. They want to kind of throw their weight around. So there's a lot wrapped up into it. The last thought that I have really quick, and it's a very different scenario, but I, for some reason, I really like, you know, dance hall. We talk about dance hall a lot on the show, or it's mentioned at least sometimes. And I remember when all there was that kind of human rights work around, you know, kind of like violent anti-gay lyrics in dance hall.
Right.
And, you know, and I think that, again, there's a lot in that conversation. Why are British people obsessed with lyrics and Jamaican music? You know, like there's all sorts of places that you can go in that conversation. But a downside of globalization is homogenization and all the rest. But a potential upside is at least a forcing of all of a sudden for a Chinese consumer brands company. That's a conversation that they need to confront, and they would not have had, just as a matter of practical reality, this never would have been an issue in another environment.
Correct.
Just as it probably wouldn't be an issue to like say, hey, maybe I'm not going to put out this record where I say we should light some gay dude on fire because it might affect my tour dates in the UK. And I think that, you know, that is the way that it's just a reflection of proliferation of information and all the different variables that we have to keep in mind. And I guess I would just encourage us in this environment not to be relativistic, but to not be sanctimonious and self-righteous.
Not to be relativistic?
Like, I think there's the extreme is to kind of say like, oh, you know, like, I saw like the backlash to the backlash. Like the first wave around this ad was it's disgusting, this is the most racist ad ever. And then we'll get to it in a second. I'm queuing you up, Phil, to kind of like, well, wait a second, let's not be so self-righteous here, and you know, let's not demonize the Chinese and all of this, which of course I don't want to demonize anybody and I don't want us to be self-righteous, but I guess what I would say by don't be a relativist is taking that to the extreme and still not at the same time saying, yeah, all that, don't be self-righteous, don't demonize anybody. And this is a fucked up ad, and we can say it, and we don't have to sort of like explain it away.
Right. Yeah, right. I mean, we should be able to walk and chew gum at the same time.
Or talk and chew gum,
I could highlight that the ad is a terrible ad, but then also put it in some sort of cultural context, I think, to your point, Rob, that to certain extent, and that's why I wasn't like totally as outraged as maybe others were in the sense that I looked at the ad and I was like, well, what would I expect from China? You know, this is still a fairly closed society.
Except on the upper ends. Yeah.
They don't have, and even for those who have experienced the world, they don't have like, there is no 5 or 10 or 15% of their population that's anything. You know, their population is pretty fucking homogenous, you know, and with some exception of, you know, outside workers and stuff that go over there, there's expats, but those are in the big cities. I mean, it's an interesting contextual conversation to have because, yes, the ad is terrible, but they're not thinking about anybody but their particular audience. You know, if it wasn't for outsiders, there's no one sitting there in Shanghai who's really feeling this as a huge problem, not in the way that we are,
of course, right?
You know, and so to that extent, I kind of looked at it and said, "Okay, this is not surprising in any way to me. This is kind of like par for the course of what I would expect for a place like this, particularly if they're copying an ad, there was an Italian ad." Which is what this is based off of, that basically takes this, they took this premise and shifted it. The Italian ad has the same setup with the exception of it's a Italian guy, kind of average looking schlubby Italian guy in underwear that's also kind of flirting with a woman. And then when she sees him, she does the exact same thing. She puts the laundry detergent in his mouth, shoves him inside the laundry machine and then washing machine, and then he comes out but as this sort of like muscular buff black guy, and the product is not actually detergent, it's more of a coloring products. It kind of does the opposite, where I think the tagline is colored is better. Mm-hmm. You know, so they kind of took the premise of that and flipped it. That ad is problematic too in mm-hmm. its fetishization of black skin and black sexual prowess, I guess, if you look at the way the woman is looking at the guy, and there's just a lot of stuff going on there. And I'm like, yeah, like, we got to move beyond these sort of lazy stereotypes. You know, I think I played an ad for you guys a while ago, Joe Piscopo, who's a 80s comedian.
Before your time.
Yeah, known on SNL. Well,
I grew up watching on VHS, Best of Saturday Night Live, Eddie Murphy.
So you've seen
Joe Piscopo. I did know who Joe Piscopo is, but that's the only reason why I knew him, yeah.
Yeah, and he does a commercial for Budweiser where he's in Asian face, you know, like he's literally dressed up like Bruce Lee, like kind of doing the voice and the, and it's terrible.
That ad is crazy.
That ad is crazy. That's like 1986 or 7. Like it ain't that long ago when we was out here on some wild shit. We'd still like, and but we're worse because we got Asian populations here. Like we have like countervailing forces, right. And people at that beer ad still thought that was a good idea.
Yeah, but also that was 1986.
Yeah.
And in the early
But I'm saying 80s, that wasn't that long ago.
It wasn't that long ago, but it was also the beginning of just, you know, diversity in corporate America. Like yeah. the 80s, that was like you were six. If you picked 1980 as a start of that, you were 6 years into that, you know, diversifying in middle management in corporate America. So there was not a lot of sensitivity back then. So America has its own issues, and, you know, we shouldn't be wagging our finger too hard, you know, at anybody, because our shit ain't perfect over here either. So,
yeah. All right, let's get to what's up.
Jumping into what's up, our story today comes from kind of the media world. I think we spend a lot of time in that space. And right now, one of the big stories is sort of a David and Goliath story, where you have famed or infamous venture capitalist and Silicon Valley entrepreneur Peter Thiel, who has been waging a legal battle against Gawker Media by funding, by way of proxy, the Hulk Hogan lawsuit. And just a slight background on not getting into too much of the Hulk Hogan situation, but the first iteration of the case, there was basically a $140 million judgment against Gawker. This is a huge amount of money for a company that, though, has a lot of reach, doesn't really have deep pockets to pay $140 million judgments. And Nick Denton, who is the head of Gawker Media, has long speculated, both slightly privately and also now publicly, that the Hulk Hogan lawsuit was being funded by some outside source that has a vendetta against Gawker Media. And as it turns out, that person is, like I said, the infamous, famous Peter Thiel. And
boo!
Yeah, a classic villain. But the implications for this are fairly significant as we start to wonder, you know, what does the media look like? What does the press look like when those who are in particularly privileged spaces, whether that's due to their influence, their financial influence or their social influence, you know, what kind of impact can they have on the way our media is presented? You know, we covered a little bit of this a couple of weeks ago when we talked about Facebook and the fact that they may have been steering their trending topics away from reporting or highlighting conservative news, you know, or conservative topics. So you're starting to see, again, as more and more power is coalesced in fewer and fewer hands, there's some serious implications to media and journalism, regardless of where one might fall down on a Facebook or on a Gawker in particular. Peter Thiel is on the board of Facebook, full disclosure for Peter Thiel. So, you know, I think that's a good place for us to start.
Yeah, I mean, he has a clear political agenda, and he has, you know, I mean, he's a Donald Trump supporter. He has a very extreme, weird, far-out libertarian thing. But, you know, even tabling that for a moment, this isn't even about politics. This is that he doesn't like how Gawker covered him. He doesn't like that they They did in fact out him several years ago. That's the root of the anger at Gawker, but they didn't. You know, we can debate the kind of inherent ethics of outing somebody, but they didn't. They didn't do it in a, you know, hostile and adversarial manner on that specific regard. They've been hostile to Peter Thiel and any number of other things in terms of his business practices and his politics. But the point is that Peter Thiel funded this lawsuit from this wrestler just to bankrupt a media company he didn't like for very personal reasons, let alone if he, you know, as an example, Gawker and their kind of funny hybrid with all their gossip and everything else, they actually do on certain inequality issues, certain new economy issues, cover those things pretty intelligently and pretty aggressively, and in a way that if you were a kind of, you know, delusional libertarian plutocrat, you wouldn't appreciate. And I also think that, you know, connected to that, we have to kind of contend with this notion that the money that has been generated in the tech economy is going to somehow come and migrate and save traditional media. It's not that new forms and new platforms and new pay models and things like this aren't being created. And it's not that there isn't, I think, some very real potential for brands, for media companies, and for content creators. But the notion that, you know, there's a bunch of Jeff Bezoses out there that are just going to kind of swoop in and try to save newspapers and save, you know, even online outlets at this point that are already in pretty, you know, in danger. I mean, first of all, that in and of itself is not going to happen. And secondly, there's another great example of this notion that you could sort of trust the whims of any of these quote unquote benevolent people was always delusional. And now with this activity, I think just sort of a great kind of case study and illustration of how just sort of stunningly dangerous that premise is.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's interesting to me about this is, you know, sort of if we even take a step back a little bit further to the things that, you know, both of you have sort of mentioned, but you know, and it remains to be seen whether or not this lawsuit is going to, on appeal, be struck down or anything like that, or if they're not going to have to pay the $140 million or whatever like that. But just the fact that it was done puts it out there that this is an approach that you can take. You know, if you have the resources, this is how you shut down a media company. This is how you...
And just to be clear, it is a common practice in law to fund, you know, lawsuits.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's a growth area.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, and particularly in an age when it's particularly a delicate situation now in an age when we are as a country so very polarized. Media is... On one hand, it's not trusted. It's not seen as valuable. It's not seen as objective. Like, it's not seen as a place you go to get the information, where people just now see media as a place where you go to get opinions and, you know, that validates opinions. So, you know, this is all a long slide in the overall erosion, I think, of sort of the trust in journalism. And in media,
why would that be a trust, an erosion of a trust in journalism when, and just in this specific case, when they've been the target?
They've been the target, yeah. but I just say it's in this environment where, you know, like a lot of people didn't like Gawker, and, you know, the more you know about Gawker, hey, it was cool what they did in terms of building the company on one hand. On the other hand, there have been tons of stories about the sweatshop he ran for years.
Definitely.
And, you know, he got rich while so many of his writers just, you know, made no money. And so, you know, capitalism once again, right? But I do think that, you know, we have gotten into this age where just the general respect for institutions seems to be at an all-time low. And I don't know, I think there's a larger issue at play here around if there is nothing worth nothing that you respect, then What do we have as a society, and what is springing up to kind of help bind us together. You know, not that the old world was perfect in any way, but still it was like all these kinds of institutions, like journalist or science, is looked upon as, well, that's an opinion. It's like, no, that's science, you know. So I wonder, and I'm just concerned too, that this is just this further sort of like erosion of what journalism, as vital as it is for democracy, is coming to stand for people.
Yeah, I think Gawker, you know, love them or hate them, you know, I'm not trying to keep them in somewhat perspective, because there are a lot of problematic things about Gawker,
tons.
You know, not just their business practices, their editorial, you know, yeah. Sometimes, you know, they be wilding, but you know, I think generally speaking, when you have so few institutions that are actually holding those in power to any sort of standard,
right.
Gawker through and its affiliate sister sites, sometimes they seem as if they're one of the only ones, like right. In their own sort of irreverent way.
Exactly.
You know, they're holding people to, they're calling out those sort of inconsistencies, the sort of hypocrisies that exist within these power structures, whether it's a Silicon Valley or standard corporate America or other media practices. And, you know, when you read that in little bite-sized nuggets, it becomes, you know, sometimes funny, sometimes interesting. It covers a lot of your bases when so few people seem to be doing that in the institutions yeah. that used to be noted for, you know, speaking truth to power.
No, absolutely. And I think not only that, I mean, whatever else you, and I have, I guess, a pretty high degree of tolerance for snark. And sometimes I think Gawker can be pretty funny. Other times I just think it's, you know, it's not like it bothers me, but it's like, all right, whatever. Like, I don't need to read this garbage right now. But by that same token, I mean, there have been many moments with Gawker where, you know, if you're following, as an example, an aspect of the inequality crisis or a conversation about taxes, you will have actually a much more rigorous understanding of the issue reading Gawker than many other sort of more kind of branded as serious outlets. And I think that I agree with what you're saying about this, Rob, about this kind of lack of trust in institutions and this sort of global collapse in this, you know, from religion to government to journalism to science to really everything. I mean, there was a while where actually the military was sort of held up in a higher regard than a lot, and that disturbed me, frankly. I don't think it's a healthy societal attitude to have a collapse in all of these other kind of institutions. But my kind of response to that, and I think it's all our jobs to some degree, in journalism and culture and strategy and writing and whatever the ventures we're in, to help maybe recreate this. Because the reality is that, you know, justifiably so, of course people have very little trust in all these institutions. I mean, it has been it's just imploded under the weight of so many contradictions that have produced horrible results for people. And, you know, even in the realm of science, I mean, I agree with you when people are disputing, you know, the science of global warming, as an example, you know, when questioning, you know, basic scientific methodology. But by the same token, I mean, how much has science been, you know, perverted by that same token, a company that can enlist the scientists to do work to, you know, debunk climate science, as an example. How many climate scientists have been on the payrolls of Exxon and other oil companies, or, you know, back in the day, you know, co-signing that tobacco isn't dangerous. So I think
delusion about like how we should have low-fat diets.
Exactly. And that's not even as sinister. That's just a silly fad yeah. that there's a lot of money to be made in.
Yeah.
And so all of this stuff is – so I think we got to really ask ourselves, how do you actually rebuild this stuff?
Yeah. I mean, because you're chasing – everything goes to the lowest common denominator when you're chasing sort of the click.
Mass you know, consumption.
Yeah, you're chasing this idea that, you know, this only has value if it's viral.
Yes.
You know, this only means something if certain number of people have clicked on it or liked it or right. commented in some way, regardless of the the value and the validity of those comments. You know, no headline is too salacious. No story is too bottom of the barrel. You know, like all of these companies are just chasing that. So whether it's the New York Times and, you know, kind of, you know, New York Times does great work, but they also have like a sponsored content department where they're building out editorial that is really just ads. You know, we talked about that a few weeks ago. Like a lot of these trends are sort of connected and they lead us into places like this. You know, it becomes easy to attack these foundations because these companies aren't built on that much in the first place, right? You know, and the person who has, in this case, a Peter Thiel, who has the most amount of money and he has the longest time horizon, you know, he can wait forever on this. You know, this is not what his primary thing is. And so paying $10, $15, $20 million of legal fees is a drop in the bucket to a guy that's worth whatever couple billion dollars that he's worth. It's right. Literally pocket change. So how does really any media company deal with that? You know, when they don't have anywhere near those sorts of resources, how does any person, doesn't have to be a media company? And I think when I read these stories, it reminds me so much of like my favorite show, Deadwood. You know, I'm a huge Deadwood fan. And like when George Hearst like enters the Deadwood scene in the last couple of seasons, you know, he's just the guy who, you know, just wants to see the world burn. You know, he doesn't care about the town or anything.
He's the
like
Joker.
That. He's the Joker of Deadwood times.
I haven't seen Deadwood, but that's
Oh man, Joker. You gotta watch Deadwood, yeah. Dude. That is a must watch.
Ian McShane.
Best show.
It's time to go to What's Good.
What's Good.
All right, so now we got to get to what's good and kind of dealing with the theme of this show to some degree, which is about power, because we're always talking about power in one form or another, David versus Goliath, and how we're going to kind of address and kind of invent our way out of some of the challenges we face. I want to highlight some reporting in The Guardian that talked about two sort of interactive, experimental pieces of art that are incredibly ambitious that two different sets of artists, one in LA, one in New York, are working on to highlight, really, I guess, broadly speaking, the inequality crisis and, you know, dealing with issues of access and all the rest, but specifically in the geography and the economics of LA and New York. So let me just quote a little bit from this article about these specific projects. It's an incredibly interesting way of using art to address these challenges, and I think we'll see more of that. So this is from pieces by Alex Rayner, and we'll have a link to it in our notes. But Alex starts, "The residents of LA's Skid Row have faced many perils, yet they haven't up until now had to contend with golf-related injuries. This may change in a little over 6 months' time when a new 9-hole course is scheduled to open in this Los Angeles neighborhood, home to as many as 6,000 of America's homeless." That's an incredible stat, I just have to say parenthetically. "These urban fairways are not the work of some misguided sports facility developer, but a collaboration between local artist Rostin Wu and the Los Angeles Poverty Department, LAPD," which is funny abbreviation there. LAPD could mean a very different thing. "A performance art and activist group based in the area. Wu intends to create the Back Nine, a playable course of 9 holes inside LA's Skid Row as a way of addressing the current and historic zoning issues." So then jumping ahead, just to give you a taste of what's going on in New York, Jennifer Dalton and William Pohida are currently, and this is back to the article, quote, "currently closing the stages of their month-to-month project, a series of public art events held in private residencies across New York City about how class, wealth, and social mobility affect people's ability to prosper in the city. The pair have worked together in the past and produced paintings, drawings, photographs, and installations and other works individually." And so that project is going to be about the sort of lived experience of people who don't have the, you know, all of the varieties of lack of access and lack of mobility in New York City. I think what's interesting in contrasting these new projects is that, you know, in LA, Skid Row is still, you know, that is not a gentrified phenomenon. That is a still absolutely sort of very much on the margins, very much, if we use the Manuel Rawlerstein language from international relations, on the periphery versus the center. And of course, sort of built into the city, but of course, very much not serviced by the city at all. A lot of people being left in very precarious positions. And then in New York, we've already, you know, I think more so than LA, much more kind of aggressive, intense gentrification in a certain way, and straight up under Giuliani, like attacks on the homeless that were really quite physical. So now we're seeing artists take it on in this very different way. And I think the ambition and the scope of these projects speak to the sort of more interactivity we're going to see, and more of these types of things dealing with the very environments where art supposedly flourish. Because I think the subtext to all of these things is, how can you have flourishing art communities in cities that are known for it when, you know, artists can't afford to be there? So I want to open it like that, and then get both of your thoughts. Take it from there.
I kind of wrestled with this a little bit.
Yeah.
To be honest, like, I thought both the artists, or the artist collective, since it's a group in both places kind of collaborating on this, I thought they had some interesting things to say.
Right.
But I definitely think there's some limitations to their approach.
The Skid Row one is really questionable.
Yeah, it's, yeah. I'm kind of like, when these are real people, right, and real, like, real serious issues around folks being displaced and losing their home, and just the machinations that go into rezoning. Like, rezoning isn't arbitrary. Mm, yep. And I think that's one of the things that, like, when I have conversations about gentrification, particularly from a New York lens, since I'm in New York, I'm from New York, like, it takes a long time. Like, in around where I live at, Fort Greene, the changes that are happening to Fort Greene have been planning for decades now. You know, like, they're not something that just sort of happened by accident. Like, a lot of things needed to come together to make them happen, but they were definitely in the works since way before Fort Greene and Clinton Hill became a thing, you know? Yeah. So I'm kind of like, once these artists do this work and they have these salons and they have these talks, you know,
including Gentrifiers Anonymous.
Yeah.
Which
then
is
what?
which is the whodunit. Like, what's the game that people play?
It's a murder mystery,
theater, except on gentrification. So there's definitely a way in which these activities could just as easily turn into pornography, voyeurism, and just also sitting around and being like, yeah, wow, we created this terrible problem. Okay.
Yeah,
well, so maybe we feel better that we know it.
Yeah, I would love at some point to maybe talk to one or both and kind of get a little bit more of their perspective. Like, I read this article and I hear some good things. You know, they quote one of the artists, Pajita, you know, where they say, you know, the work that they're doing, quote, "It is way in for talking about larger inequality issues. Housing becomes a lens of segregation in this country," you know, and I do believe that, you know, neighborhoods, ghettos, whatever you want to call them, lower income neighborhoods are created. You know, they're not a function of the moral failings of the people who live there. They're
even just the magic of the market.
Yeah, they're purposeful in their design, you know. And you know, I've read, like, Crabgrass Frontier, for example, by Kenneth Jackson, which kind of talks deeply about these issues using Chicago as a lens. You know, out in Long Island, we have Levittown, mm-hmm. you know, which was a community built in the 40s after World War II, literally to house, you know, former soldiers, you know, ex-GIs, kind of a GI community that excluded, you know, people of color. You know, they literally could not buy homes in Levittown, you know, and so again, these sort of mobility in housing is a construct oftentimes of race and culture. And I'm not sure if these artists, though very well-meaning and well-intentioned, if what this work will do toward addressing that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the challenge with all these things, and particularly when you read about
you know, this a 9-hole golf course in Skid Row. It's like, yeah. Are the homeless people in Skid Row going to be playing golf? Right. Is that happening? And more to the point, if you are doing projects that address gentrification, to what extent do they actually involve the people who live in those neighborhoods? Because so often it's like, oh, we want to bring a voice and talk about it. It's like, on one hand, these salons talk about, seem like they are gatherings for folks who own their homes to get together and talk about, yeah, I feel bad, blah, 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 but I'm glad I brought my $2 million brownstone. You know, I mean, we barely were able to afford it. I mean, but even being able to say that puts you on a whole other level, and it does not begin to bring in the people who are being displaced or who are struggling to find places to live. So on one hand, if these things can begin to further shed some light. But I mean, after sitting through all 9 episodes of There Goes the Neighborhood, I mean, you know, and there's been so much talk about gentrification lately anyway. So it's like this, in some ways, these seem a little late to the party.
Right.
And there needs to be okay, this was great, but now what else are we going to do now that we've gathered all this attention around this issue in Skid Row or in New York and these salons on the wherever they're having them? What else are we going to do to kind of, you know, help level the playing field a little bit? You know, that's the question with these.
So my question then for both of you is, because I agree in terms of the critique specifically of these two projects completely. And then I feel like we also like, yeah, what are we going to do? Well, there's massive policy changes and redistribution. I mean, you know, there are really serious programmatic questions.
Yeah.
But to the extent that art and culture has a role in highlighting these problems – and then we don't want
is
it to be.
Is that a good thing?
It a good thing? And we don't want it to be an indulgence. And right, we don't want to like. But what role is it going to play to keep opening that conversation?
Well, the artist always has the role of shining a light and saying the things that society doesn't want to hear. You know, that's kind of the role of the artist to, you know, there was some quote I saw someplace. The role of the artist is to, you know. To chip away at the things that society doesn't really want to touch, but with love and everything, just because with this whole idea being that it should be with this desire to increase human understanding of what's going on, because so often we can be blind to or willfully ignorant of what's going on around us. I mean, I think music has always played a role in helping people sort of process what they're going through. You know, you look at the music that came out during the Civil Rights Movement, for example, or, you know, the music that, you know, sort of came out during, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, during the Stop the Violence Movement, hip hop and everything. It was just like really about trying to give voice and help people process, you know, or you look at, you know, we talked about Kendrick Lamar and how that's an album of the moment. You know, so art always has had and will continue, I think, to have this role of, you know, helping people just process, because a lot of what people feel in these highly charged times, be it about real estate or, you know, institutional issues, institutions versus individuals or communities, is they feel a lot of emotion, but they don't really understand what it is or how can't articulate it in a way. And the art helps them process that. And be like, that's how I feel. And it helps them have a place to start a conversation about whatever situation if they did not have the words or capacity to speak of it themselves, just by somebody doing something and like, yeah, I was feeling that way too, or this is how I was feeling, or, you know. And so, you know, that's why art is so important.
Yeah. And I think those on the other side, they recognize that. Mm-hmm. Like, that's why we need to be wary of how art is sometimes also used as sort of like the vanguard, the shock troops, to walk into developing neighborhoods and create the very sort of beginning of the cultural swing and, you know, tide swing that we're talking about. You know, when I think about over here in
Soho.
In New York, so Soho, you know,
Bushwick.
Yeah, it's the galleries that start. Same you know,
it's the same
and
process,
and they focus on, you know, a certain demographic. Certain artwork gets, you know, elevated over other artwork. You know, so though that's sort of the yin and yang that I think art always has a place to play because it gives voice to things that we often cannot. But we should be wary also of how it's being used in, you know, not judging the intent of these folks mentioned in this article, but just thinking about broadly, a lot of real estate developers, as they even cited here, will use like, oh, we're going to commission some artists to do like the mural on our new like 40-story luxury condo. You know, like that's a real thing that kind of happens to be like, look, we're helping the community.
It's enough to bring out the inner Maoist in anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that the last thing I would say just as a, and I don't know why I insist on continuing to share this with my audiences because it's very disturbing, but it always comes up every time I have this kind of conversation that involves any issue involving displacement, gentrification, who's in, who's out. Manuel Castells, who is a communications scholar and kind of theorist of global communication, he wrote in one of his books, and he's a, you know, very, very credible source, and there should be more, you know, looking into this, but it's a very plausible charge from a very credible source that the Cali cartel, who was the sort of prime rival of Pablo Escobar's Medellin cartel, Cali, and they were the more kind of upper crust cartel, and actually much more powerful than Pablo Escobar, arguably. They practiced social cleansing in Cali, according to Manuel Castells, in conjunction with police force and other kind of local authorities. And they would basically do like killing raids on homeless people and other, you know, quote unquote, undesirables. And they would hang signs that said, clean Cali, beautiful Cali. And, you know, that was their branding and social cleansing campaign. And obviously you never can make the comparison between something as horrific as that in between to something that, you know, is going on in Brooklyn. But at the same time, it's one of those things where if you actually made the direct comparison, you'd be being ridiculous. But if you said, oh, those two things have absolutely nothing to do with each other, then you wouldn't be getting, at the very least, a worthwhile imaginative connection in terms of how we treat and, you know, flow out these things in terms of certain populations and who's in and who's out. And so these, you know, these issues obviously aren't going anywhere. And I do think art and at least the empathy and moral imagination of that are part of it. But these, you know, these projects are major question marks.
And you know, all art is done by people and people are flawed. And so, you know, you gotta, at least if you can determine that the intent was honorable, then let's see how it rides and see how it plays out, you know.
And dig in, you know. Maybe we'll get a chance to talk to these folks and find out more about what they're doing.
Absolutely. That's what's good. Let's get to the crates, gentlemen.
The crates. This comes from a group that I loved when I was coming up, and they're called the Black Sheep. And
who's the Black Sheep?
Exactly.
It's the Black Sheep,
you know. The choice is yours. Seminal album, you know. The Black Sheep were sort of like the
shout out Lisa Cortez.
Cousins of the Native Tongues, you know, they were down with Tribe, De La, Jungle Brothers, Queen Latifah, you know, they were in that, like she had Flavor Unit, but they were in that affiliated tribe. And they were sort of like the raunchier, slightly more wild versions of Native Tongues, which is a little bit more like deeper and what have you. But Black Sheep has a great first album. Their other work is not, I'm being kind, it ain't really worth checking. But if there's an album that you want to really get down with, that's just a great party record, you know, Drez, Mr. Long, they had flows, they had beats. It's just a dope record from start to finish, and it's called The Choice Is Yours by Black Sheep.
Mr. Rob?
I have some newer things that I'm kind of excited about now. Not quite digging in the crates, but
well, the crates could be yesterday.
The crates can be yesterday. Not,
they could be anything. Fresh, clean, yes. No dust.
So I saw my wife and I saw this movie, A Bigger Splash. It's a foreign film with Tilda Swinton and Ralph Fiennes, and really good movie. It takes place on this little island off the coast of Sicily. She's a singer who's recovering from vocal injury, so she can't talk through most of the movie. And Rafe is her former producer / lover / Svengali, and she's with this new guy, and there's a whole like triangle or quadrangle that develops. But the countryside and the sense of place, like, you know how a lot of movies could have taken place anywhere, this was so very much about this sort of like Italian island and the terrain of it and the weather of it and whatnot. And it was just really great. So I highly recommend that. Still in theaters now. We saw it at BAM like about a week ago. So it's called A Bigger Splash. And the more, actually this is kind of digging the crates because this came out about a few months ago. But I do think Kent Jones' song, Don't Mind, is the pop hook to beat for the summer right now. That's the one where you guys can pull the music on that. And that is the pop hook to beat. I mean, it's just so catchy and just so... I feel like he is a... I'd be surprised if he had like a whole body of work. I'm happy to be wrong about that, but he seems like, this feels like one of those one hit amazing, didn't you just love that song, and then his next song is not gonna be as good as this. Kind of like Fetty Wap, you know. It's just like it just is what it is.
Fetty. Sorry to get him on our point. Don't mess this up, dude.
But you should have told me before this. But
Fair enough.
But fair Kent enough. Jones, Don't Mind, I do think, you know, until we hear something from somewhere out there in the recorded world, that is the pop hook to beat for the summer.
There it is.
Beautiful. And I just have to say, man, wow, I'm bringing the negativity today, talking about the Cali cartel. And now I've got to say that everybody, I feel like this made a lot of waves when it came out a couple of years ago. It's a documentary called The Act of Killing. I don't know how many people, I know it was nominated for an Oscar. Basically, in Indonesia in the 1960s, there were hundreds of thousands of communists and ethnic Chinese that were killed by the Suharto government that came into power. But as in many other places, like in Indonesia, but Haiti, Bosnia, many other places where there are kind of these systemic killings and war crimes, it's usually contracted out to paramilitaries and to gangsters. So what this film director Joshua Oppenheimer did was he actually went to Indonesia, and this is first of all a place where this history has never been accounted for. It's still told as kind of like a positive point and totally justified that this happened. People who participated in mass killings are still treated like heroes on the street, and there's no kind of public recognition of these crimes. There's never been anything remotely approaching like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission or anything like that. So he met with a couple of these guys who participated in the killings, and essentially they reenact their killings. They actually direct and almost take a film approach to their sort of killing sprees. And it's kind of this documentary, but almost like magical realist nightmare that really gets, and also in all the interplays between films, mass violence, and unaccounted history, and, you know, normal people getting drawn up in these things, because, you know, at a certain point when a certain number of people reach critical mass, you can't just say, oh, well, you know, they're all psychopaths or whatever. I mean, it's a lot of people participating in a lot of kind of unimaginable cruelty. But it's a fascinating and disturbing and I guess just because of the actual environment, kind of sickly beautiful in some moments, just because it's, you know, that's just the space. But The Act of Killing. Phil.
What up, what up?
Another expedition, man.
Great journey.
Always. Rob Fields.
A little dark there, Michael.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, you know, I got my range. Sometimes I got to remind everybody.
Bass clef here, man.
It's not all
fun and games.
It's not all charm and Trump impressions.
Exactly. Right. Sometimes
we gotta, I never even got a Trump
impression.
Down the
dark side.
I never even got a Trump impression.
Well, I'll give it to you later when I'm more elevated.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks, Super Producer Matt Leck.
Super Producer Matt Leck.